You're listening to Norman Otis Richmond and Dr. Gerald Horn. This is the Horn Report. And how have you been doing, my good friend?
Working hard. How about you?
Probably working a little bit harder.
I
wanted to talk to you about maybe about five things today. I guess the first thing that's on my mind is that December 4th will be the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Fred Hampton, the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. And there is a new biography called The Assassination of Fred Hampton, How the FBI and the Chicago Police Murdered Fred Hampton, or murdered a Black Panther. Have you seen that book? And probably haven't read it, of course, but what are your thoughts on the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Chairman Fred Hampton?
Well, I'm certainly familiar with the book, and I think what this 40th anniversary reminds us is of the cruelty, quite frankly, of the authorities in the United States. Recall that it was early in the morning, 2, 3, 4 a.m., that they burst into a Chicago flat and basically murdered him in his bed. It was quite tragic, and it also reminds us of what happens to progressive movements. Those who wonder how and why it is why the progressive forces in the United States are so paltry and so weak need only study the murder of Fred Hampton. That is to say that the progressive forces have been subjected to a steamroller of oppression. It happened then, it's happening now, but fortunately, that kind of oppression is not saving the skin of U.S. imperialism, which continues to suffer one blow after another. And the fact that you have the counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, that has been deployed historically to repress and suppress progressive forces will not save the skin of U.S. imperialism.
Next question about Fred Hampton. Very briefly, I wanted to know, is there anything taking place, to your knowledge, regarding Chairman Fred Hampton anywhere other than in Chicago? His former wife, Akua Najiri, formerly Deborah Johnson, has been commemorating his assassination every December 4th. Do you know of anything that's taking place any place else in the United States or outside the United States?
No, I do not. I do know of a number of events in Chicago, but nothing beyond Chicago.
Okay. The current president of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama, is of Kenyan ancestry. We also know that Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, who was the Minister of Defense of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party, he, when he was in Soledad Prison, one of the things that his people used to do was, in order to be a part of his group, you had to take the Mau Mau Oath. And Halle Berry, I remember the very first time I saw Halle Berry on TV, the actress Halle Berry, she was talking very positively about going to school with a Kenyan and wanting to visit Kenya. Now your new book, Mau Mau in Harlem, is just been released. And what has been the response to Mau Mau in Harlem in terms of reviews and the feedback that you have received from it?
Well, the feedback is positive, I think, in part because your first point, that is to say that the current occupant of the White House is of Kenyan ancestry, and I think that this book that details the relationship between the United States and Kenya leading up to independence in December 1963 is the first intensive study on this question, and it's a study that provides a central background for trying to understand how a man of Kenyan ancestry ascended to be the president of the United States. It's quite a unique story. I'm not sure if we'll wrap our heads around the significance of it until probably he leaves the White House. And certainly I think that's one of the reasons why this book has gotten a fair amount of attention.
Now, when we talk about Barack Obama, you know, there is such a thing that exists in Africa and even in Europe called tribalism. And we know that the Kikuyu, the Mau Maus, predominantly came from the Kikuyu ethnic group. And Barack Hussein Obama and his father are from the Luo ethnic group, and the Luo ethnic group has people in Uganda, Tanzania, and Kenya. And the Luos, from what I understand and from what you talk about, is they were given more education, and the Mau Maus were the, you know, the Mau Maus came out of the Kikuyu group, and people like Dedan Kimathi, and to a lesser extent, the so-called Burning Spear, Jomo Kenyatta, was, I guess he became president. But we know that Dedan Kimathi, General China, and others were really the leaders of the Mau Mau. Could you talk about the, you know, the difference between the Luos and the Kikuyu, and how that relates to your book, Mau Mau in Harlem?
Well, it plays out in part because of the predicate of your question. That is to say, it was a perception, a widespread perception, that the Kikuyu were spearheading this movement for national liberation in the 1950s, and with their usual attempt at divide and rule, the British settler class dominant in Nairobi thought that if they could win over the Luo group, then that would help to squash the Kikuyu-led resistance, or so it was perceived and thought. And in that context, you had the trip to the United States and to North America generally of Tom Mboya, a labor leader who was of Luo ancestry, who before Nelson Mandela's trip to this continent in 1990 was probably the most celebrated African to ever hit these shores. I mean, he appeared on all the Sunday talk shows in the United States. He was on the cover of Time magazine. He met with John Kennedy and Richard Nixon. And in that context, he negotiated a deal with Kennedy and other members of the U.S. elite to have an airlift of students to attend college in the United States. And it was out of that airlift that you saw Barack Hussein Obama Sr. wind up at the University of Hawaii, where in one of his first classes, a class, interestingly enough, in Russian, he meets Stanley and Dunham. They fall in love, and of course, they produce a child who is now the leader of the United States of America. So this Kenyan relationship, as you see, has been essential for the history of this country, at least.
Now, there is a big controversy about Barack Hussein Obama and his relationship to Afghanistan. I know that the night he was elected, I was interviewed by the CBC, and I basically took the position that if Barack Hussein Obama decided to send troops into Afghanistan, that that would be essentially the end of him. When I say the end of him, I mean he would lose his popularity among people around the world. He might keep his popularity among African Americans and other African people in the Western Hemisphere, in the Caribbean, and so on and so forth. And it looks as if he's going to go into Afghanistan. And how do you think that's going to play out if and when he goes into Afghanistan? Do you think that I would be correct, or do you think that the world would embrace this move because of the perceived he would be doing a great service by rooting out, you know, the evil forces in Afghanistan?
Well, he's going to have to pull a rabbit out of the hat to make this Afghanistan venture turn out positive. But I think it's important for people to have some historical background in order to understand how we arrived at this point. It's well known that in December 1979, the then Soviet Union sent troops into Afghanistan. But one of the reasons they sent troops was that earlier that year, the United States began a destabilization campaign against an infant left-wing regime in Kabul. And that intervention by U.S. imperialism wound up succeeding. It wound up succeeding insofar as it basically routed all of the progressive forces in Afghanistan, liquidated them politically, if not physically, creating a vacuum that was then filled by religious zealots who now we characterize as the Taliban, ably assisted, I might add, by Pakistani intelligence, which also has been leaning in that particular direction. And, of course, there is a danger that Pakistan, the civilian regime, will be overthrown, as it has been overthrown repeatedly in preceding decades. And so the situation in that part of the world does not look very good for a U.S. military intervention after they spent so much time and effort building up the same forces that they're now trying to overthrow. I'm speaking of the Taliban-like forces. That particular irony has not, I'm afraid, percolated into the peace movement in the United States, at least. I mean, for example, I recall the last progressive leader of Afghanistan, Najibullah. You recall that the Soviets pulled out in 1989, and it was expected that Najibullah would fall. But he lasted for about 2.5 years. And I recall an interview that he gave to the New York Times in early 1992, where he warned the North Atlantic countries they should come to his assistance, because if they did not, he would be overthrown and they would find themselves battling those they had been supporting. Well, voila, that is precisely what is happening as we speak. And I think there's a lesson for all of us to garner if we are to come out of this episode with enhanced intelligence and enhanced political acuity. And that is, of course, the danger of supporting these zealots to overthrow and destabilize left-wing progressive regimes. It'll be interesting to see if Mr. Obama will address what I just referenced at his speech that he plans to give in West Point, the military academy in New York, on Tuesday, December 1st. We shall see if he does so.
Well, Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin, formerly H. Rap Brown, used to say that, "I have a bit of advice to the left. That advice is don't get left." And I think that the Black is Back Coalition, who had a demonstration on November the 7th, was trying to bring that message to the African world and to the American people. And they did not get a great turnout, but it looks like that was a very historical event, because it looks like, no matter what the numbers were, it looks like it was a success, because I think that, you know, the fact that someone opposed, you know, Obama's positions on not only Afghanistan, but Colombia, AFRICOM, the Congo, Somalia, and, you know, just his whole international policy, as well as the attacks on the African-American or African community inside the United States and Canada, is going to resonate. How did you perceive the Black is Back initiative?
Well, it didn't gain that much traction, as your statement suggests. It garnered, as I understand it, a turnout in the hundreds. But in your litany with regard to the foreign policy disasters that are now afflicting the United States, I would add a few more. One is the situation in Honduras and Central America, where approximately 130 days ago, there was an illegal coup d'etat against the Zelaya regime. There's an election scheduled for November 29th that Latin America plans not to recognize. Apparently, Washington will recognize it. I'm not sure what the position of Canada will be, but certainly there are many who are outraged that the United States plans to recognize this illegal election. And then secondly, there's the situation with regard to Palestine, where Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton a few weeks ago, after some cosmetic maneuvers with regard to alleged cessation of settlements by the Netanyahu right-wing regime, called this unprecedented, which was obviously an exaggeration at best. It helped to destabilize Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority, who now pledges not to run for re-election. And quite frankly, that situation is hurtling towards the abyss. But overriding everything else, it seems to me, is the fact that with Mr. Obama's recent trip to China and the recent visit of the Prime Minister of India to Washington, I understand Mr. Harper also took an Asian venture of his own. Basically, what this reflects is a shift in the balance of forces towards China specifically and Asia in general. And unfortunately and sadly, we don't have that many people in North America who are teasing out the consequences of this absolutely important event, perhaps the most important event in world history, in the last 200 years, perhaps the last 500 years. And because we have not been collectively thinking this through, it's become very difficult for us to try to understand sort of the day-to-day maneuvering of Mr. Harper or Mr. Obama, because certainly their advisors and the elites that they represent are all too aware of what I've just made reference to. And it's well past time for the progressive forces to play catch-up ball and try to ascertain what this rise of China, what this rise of India, the new role of Japan, the surging role of Asia, what does this all mean?
Now, in your book, End of Empires, African Americans and India, you pointed out that at one time in history, there was a very strong relationship between African people in the United States and India, and that India, the Indian government and the Indian people had great respect for people like W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, and that the Indian population supported the African people's struggle in the United States, South Africa. And then certain things took place, and today in 2009, going on 2010, you would never know that there was this bond between African people in the United States and the people of India. And it looks like now everybody, when people are beginning to talk about India, people are, you know, the African folks are talking about business opportunities with India and China, as opposed to, how are we going to get India to support our position? Can India speak on talk about the plight of African Americans in the United Nations? I haven't heard anybody even other than yourself talk about, you know, you are not using, but relating to India for political reasons, as opposed to, you know, just going to India to get a hustle in order to make a dollar. Could you speak on that?
Yes, that is sad and tragic indeed. But keep in mind that relationship that you spoke of between Africans in North America, such as Robeson, Du Bois, and Mr. Nehru of India, L.L. Rai of India, and other great South Asian leaders, that was a product of a particular time and age. It was a time when the leading lights in Black America, for example, were of the left, Du Bois and Robeson. We all know that as a result of McCarthyism and the Cold War, that began to change. And it's very curious that India becomes independent on August 15th, 1947, a day that Du Bois calls the greatest day in history. Black Americans begin to receive a form of full citizenship in the 1950s. And I think that what happens is when you purge the Black American leadership of the left, when Du Bois is put on trial, when Robeson is denied his passport, basically it means that we're flying blind. And we forget about the importance of international relationships. We have to rely, as a result, more upon elites in Washington in particular in order to vindicate our attempt to gain full citizenship. It's a very sad and tragic tale, but alas, it's not over. The story's not over. There's still time for us to recover. And given that U.S. imperialism is going to try to build up India in order to better confront China, this creates an opening for we of the progressive forces, we of the African community in North America, to basically take advantage of that particular contradiction and reinstall, if you like, our past relationship that once was thriving with the great and heroic people of South Asia.
There is one criticism I have of End of Empires, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, but M.N. Roy, who used to stand toe-to-toe with Vladimir Ilyich Lenin in debating the national question, not the national question, but the colonial question, M.N. Roy was involved in, I think he helped found the Communist Party in many countries, including Mexico, if I'm not mistaken. He and Lenin used to debate, and I think they had a debate. When I say a debate, they were like you go to a convention and there's one position, and they were on the same. They were in the same boat. They just had different tactics. And M.N. Roy, I think he talked about the colonial question. I think it was a big convention in Baku in the former Soviet Union. I think you've been there, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely.
And you didn't talk about the role that M.N. Roy played in the relationship between African Americans and India. And what are your thoughts on M.N. Roy?
Well, M.N. Roy comes up in the book. He doesn't have that much to say specifically about Black Americans. And as you know, with this publishing crisis that's afflicting this continent now, sadly and tragically, you can't get everything in a book that you would like because publishers are always harassing you to cut and delete and all of that. But certainly, I think if a fuller story could be told about India in particular and India's relationship to North America as opposed to Black America, more specifically, M.N. Roy would merit perhaps an entire chapter. He is one of the great South Asians. You'd have to rank him with Mr. Nehru. You'd have to rank him with Gandhi. You'd have to rank him perhaps with Mr. Jinnah, the founding father of Pakistan. So you're correct with regard to that. Actually, now that I think about it, I'd make another criticism of that book, which is that in dealing with the post-1947 dispensation in South Asia, I don't devote sufficient attention to Pakistan. I really talk mostly about India. And that was a mistake. And, of course, once again, there are publishing constraints that lead to those sorts of deletions. But it's a mistake nonetheless.
Now, let us go to, you have a new book on Du Bois coming out, which I just heard about. Now, Sam Cooke passed away, was assassinated on November the 10th or November the 11th, 1964. So we're looking at the 45th anniversary of the assassination of the great Sam Cooke. But a lot of people don't realize that Sam Cooke was a vociferous reader. And I understand from a video that I saw of his sister, she said that the library system in Chicago would allow one to check out five books at a time. And Sam's sister, Agnes, and Sam always would check out five books at a time. And if there was any city in America that Sam would go to, he knew where all of the bookstores, the libraries, and the after hours and the juke joints were. But Aretha Franklin talked about, Sam Cooke. And, no, Bobby Womack talked about Sam Cooke reading William Edward Burkhart Du Bois. Could you talk about your new book on Du Bois?
Well, it's a brief biography of Du Bois. As you know, I've been down this road before. The first book I ever published was on Du Bois this last year, and then I co-edited an encyclopedia about Du Bois. I wrote a full-scale biography of his spouse, Shirley Graham Du Bois. And this may be my last go-round at this Du Bois, Mr. Du Bois, or Mrs. Du Bois, for that matter. And it's just an overview of his life from 1868 to 1963, born in western Massachusetts, dying in Accra, Ghana, on the verge of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech at Washington, D.C., August 27th, 28th, 1963. And touches upon all of the highlights of his life with regard to Pan-Africanism, with regard to founding the NAACP, with regard to his scholarly works, Black Reconstruction, for example, perhaps being his penultimate scholarly work, his autobiographies, his novels, his plays, his poetry, etc., his being put on trial by the U.S. authorities in 1951, 1952. So, it's a book that I think many readers will find of interest.
And is there anything else you would like to add on for this interview? Because I think we're going to play Mr. Sam Cooke's If I Had a Hammer and, as they say, get the puck out of here.
Well, tell me, could you just speak briefly about Mr. Harper's recent foreign trips? I understand he's been rather busy abroad of late.
Well, he has gone to India. He went to all the regions, including the Punjab region, and he did his Sikh thing, and he looks like he's trying to play catch up because he stayed away from China during the Olympics. He didn't travel abroad, and it looks like he's playing politics, and he's trying to address. He's setting himself up for the next election, and unfortunately, and I think this is it is unfortunate that he might be reelected, because as you have been pointing out over these airwaves for many, many, many years, Mr. Michael Ignatieff, the head of the new Democratic Party, but the Liberal Party, you used the term traction. He doesn't seem to be able to get any traction in terms of really they talked about Stefan Dionne, you know, bumbling and doing, making a lot of mistakes. But, the great intellectual Mr. Ignatieff is he is really slipping. So Mr. Harper, I think, is taking advantage of that, and he is, you know, making up for lost ground. So he's going to India, and I think he is going to China. And he's essentially trying to make himself look like he is, all of a sudden, he's a, now he's an internationalist. He's no longer this isolationist, and he's, he'll be able to put on his resume that he did go to India, he did go to Singapore, and he is making a fool of himself on the climate change situation. I understand that President Obama is going to Copenhagen, and he's going to, that's on the front page of the papers today, how President Obama is upstaging Prime Minister Harper, because he's going to show up and, I guess maybe try to take a position on climate change that Mr. Harper is not. So, Mr. Harper is playing politics once again, which he is known for doing.
Well, just one more point. I think in order to save Mr. Obama from his war policies, that it's going to take a mobilization not only in the United States, not only in Canada, but worldwide. And so that would be my last word, that we have to put on our marching shoes once more. But as we do so, we should also put on our thinking caps so that we can think through the situation, and once again we'll not find ourselves on the brink of disaster as we are with regard to the situation on the Afghan-Pakistan border.
So it sounds like you're saying that once again the left cannot get left. They have to, instead of just the black is back, it's got to be the whole left, and the not only the left, but the peoples of the world have got to demonstrate to Mr. Obama, which I think President Obama, has said to hold his feet to the fire. He did tell people to do that when he was elected, I believe. I remember him saying that, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. You are correct.
Mm-hmm. All right, my brother, so thank you very much, and we will see you in the whirlwind.
Take care. Good luck.
All right, take care. And we have been speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn.
Tinkle in the morning, if I had a bell, you understand? Tinkle in the evening time, all over this land. Look, I tinkle out that danger, I tinkle out a warning, and I tinkle out love between my brothers and my sisters, all over this land. Now, if I had a song, singing in the morning, yeah, singing in the evening, all over this land home, and I'd sing out danger, sing out a warning, I'd sing out love between my brothers and my sisters, all over this land, yeah. Yeah. man. Look, I've got a hammer, and I've got a bell, yeah, and I've got a song to sing all over this land. Let me tell you what it is. Look, it's the hammer of justice, a bell of freedom, yeah. It's a song about love between my brothers and my sisters, no, all over this land. Ha! Yeah! Lord have mercy. Yeah!
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 I wonder what everybody clapped for me tonight. What you would you put your hands together and clap for? That's right, make me feel good, you know. Huh. Now that gets it. Yeah. Yeah. I wonder, do you feel like singing? Would you sing with me? Can we have one of those hoot nannies? Look, I want everybody. Everybody try this. If I had a hammer. Everybody. If I had a hammer. Here we go. Come on. If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning. I'd hammer in the morning. Hammer in the evening. I'd hammer in the evening. All over this land, all over this land. I'd hammer out danger, I'd hammer out danger. A warning, I'd hammer out a warning. Love, I'd hammer out love between my brothers and my sisters. Where? Where? You got it, now keep it, don't lose it. Bell this time. Everybody take, if I had a bell. All right, here we go. If I had a bell, Ben, I'd ring it in the call. I'm ringing in the evening. I'd ring it in the evening. All of this land. All over this land. I'd ring out danger. I'd ring out danger. And a warning. I'd ring out a warning. I like it, love. I'd ring out love. My brothers and where? Where? That's the place. Huh. Yeah. Woo. Yeah. Lord have mercy. Huh. Yeah. You want to try one more? Everybody try. If I had a song. If I had one of them songs, honey. That's all. If I had a song. Here we go. Now. If I had a song, I'd sing it in the morning. I'd sing it in the morning. Sing it in the evening. I'd sing it in the evening. All over this land. All over this land. I'd sing out danger, baby. I'd sing out danger in the morning. I'd sing out the morning. Love. I'd sing out love between my brothers and sisters. Where? Where? Over this land. Brothers and my sisters, all over this land, all over this land.